We have Yonah Rosenblum carries a banner for the Haredi world, a person who does not need any introduction, whose writings are found in virtually every Jewish publication, a prolific author and writer, who oftentimes will defend the world of Haredi Judaism. And we have Moshe Tarragon, a Ram, a Rebbe, in Gush Etzion, a pride and joy of the Dati Lumi Mizrahi world. His teachings not only limited to the land of Israel, but certainly, thank God, as I mentioned when I saw Rabbi Tarragon, thanks to YU Torah and other forms of publication dissemination, so many of us have the opportunity to hear his beautiful and enriching Torah all the time. It is a great honor to have two people who are certainly most focused on being able to connect to Hashem in their own individual ways and being able to hear from them as they, through their own communities, as they embrace and represent their individual communities, bring their communities closer to God. And with that, I'm going to hand things over to Rabbi Howard, who will moderate this very important discussion.
Good morning. Good morning. Welcome, everybody. It's a privilege for our shul to be able to host this special event. We're grateful to Rabbi Marwick and Shomei Amunah and Rabbi Watson and their Tamid. We're grateful to World Mizrahi for their encouragement and their sponsorship, their co-sponsorship of this event, along with the other sponsors who have made it possible for our community to host these two very special guests. I'm going to ask our two special guests if they could come to be seated here. There's a story which sometimes we see lives out about these two great people who just were, they couldn't get into the building. They couldn't get into the building because each one was saying, after you, after you, after you. And that's part of what's going to go on here. Let's who to go first. I know he's exercise executive privilege as far as that goes. But I want to frame. I'm going to try to be as limited and invisible as possible. I'm going to try to frame the way we have discussed setting this up. And it's a model which is good for human relationships. I'll use a metaphor which comes from a secular source. There's a very fascinating author named Jim Collins, who writes about all kinds of organizational stuff, and he wrote a book called Good to Great, and he spoke about that, how great leaders versus terrible leaders both work on a model which is called windows and mirrors. Great leaders, when they look at a situation that's going on around them, and they see that it's not going well, they look in the mirror and they say, what am I doing or what am I not doing that's making this not go so well? When they see that things are going fantastically well, they look through the window, through their office window, at all the people they have with them, and they say, oh, well, it's because of them, it's because of them, it's because of them. They don't look at themselves. Terrible leaders, when everything is going great, they look in the mirror and they're very proud of themselves. And when anything's going wrong, they look out the window and they point the finger as to what the problem is with the other person. Our privilege of hosting our guests this morning is that each of them is a leader in their own right, is a leader in the Jewish world, is a valued voice in the Jewish world. And each of them is a great Balmidos, a lover of people, a person who practices in their life, and who their work is colored by their habitude, seeing the good in others, and the ability as well to be self-critical, to be able to see how we can make ourselves better. So our first conversation, which we're going to ask our guests to engage in, we're going to ask each of them to speak, to look out the window, and to look out the window positively, and to speak about the qualities and the great benefits which our world, our Jewish world as a whole, has as the contribution of the other. Rabbi Tarragon will be speaking, so on behalf of the Dati Lumi community and the religious science community, we're going to ask him to speak about the qualities and the contributions of the Haredi community. If Rabbi Jonathan Rosenblum is speaking, as he prefers to be called without the rabbi, but he's a Talmud Chacham, a person who learns very, very seriously for a very extended period of time. It represents the Sunday Mida Haredi community. We've been asking him to share his views on the valuable contributions of the Dati Lumi community. I'm going to ask, use my executive privilege to ask Rabbi Karen to begin.
Good morning, everyone. Kodesh Tov. This is Mishim. It's a beautiful Kiddush Hashem. That's why we're here. When our ideas are our committee, just to sit together and get together on Sunday morning. A lot of Hashem, a lot of Kiddush Hashem, but think of what we just did an hour ago, 2 hours ago. So, our Hashem, we should create a Kiddush Hashem Shemayim, and it's supposed to be Kiddush Hashem, and it's supposed to be the Yafa Shalom Bari, which I'll stand firm. So, I'm going to be a very difficult time today. And it's supposed to be with an hour. Once I do the homework, and of course today with the cover Chasha of the answer, I didn't prepare.
Howard told me that I should speak about what I admire about the Haredi community.
He made a great list of 7. I don't know if I'll have that much time, so I'll just iterate it very quickly. I'll be mindful of other people. I'd be probably taking an entire hour and a half of what I admire about the community. That wouldn't be, it won't be there. Obviously, the issue that jumps out for us is the prodigious, unprecedented, massive communal commitment to help Torah. There's more Torah being learned today than at any single time since the first day of Sunday Kiddush. It's unprecedented, it's staggering, it's supernova, and the fact that it's rippling, as Mitzvah, the shot that you see in the shots of Mitzvah, you see what 90,000 people here and 100,000 people there. And of course, the Amichul and Sadiqah, and the Torah is broad, and the Torah is mighty, and the Amichul of the Torah, and called the Chimdi Zeviyechul. But less not to call it, that so much of this Torah energy is being driven by the Haredi community, because this is a community which is almost entirely sloped as a pyramid to support one cardinal value of Talmud Torah. That's the ethos, one value. And everyone, and not just the notion of that, that's how everyone sees their mahos. Woman who's married in the Haredi, woman who's married in Haredi saying, that's about to be your life. The Torah says to sit and wait for us. We come back from this marriage, the children, it's a support cover, and we all benefit from it. And look at your watches, we're benefiting now. It's 10:35, but under safe has just been published in the paper. And if you wait another 3 seconds, another safe has been published in the paper. And we all enjoy the star. And then, how could any conversation, but any issues about any community begin with any other terms? So, Baruch Hashem and Ashrei Tovim, they were able to be recipients. Number 2, I think that children need to see Mesiras Nefesh. That's really the secret of parenting, the secret of raising children. We see parents making decisions based on convenience and comfort. And they need to see people who are driven, who sacrifice comfort, personal interest, for higher ideals. I'd like to think that in my community there's some of that as well. But essentially, a person who lives in Bnei Brak and has an exception, let's take it to the extreme, is voluntarily subjecting themselves to a life of financial struggle and we have to come to Torah. And that sends a very, very resonant message to the entire family. That I'm not placed in this world just to have my salary, or just to get a nice car, or just to, I'm here for a half year, and I'm here to serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and I'll live with your Baruch Hu. And that trickles down, and that affects the way children are raised. And, children need to see Mr. Sefesh, children need to see passion. It's built that. It's built in the community that my life is one of Mr. Sefesh. And I'm willing to grow and tolerate difficulties and challenges and one choice, 14 children, in an apartment the size of this room. And it's difficult. And I'm just amazed and just so enamored with that type of decision. And I'm quite frankly jealous. I try to emulate and recreate my own life. Number 3, I'm trying to be very rude because I'm wondering why it's a little bit lopsided. What really makes, again, from my perspective as an outsider, what really makes this community tick because they're so financially challenged and because it's 2 things. And each of them are important. Number 1, the family. The family is an enterprise. Family is not something nonchalant. It is ground zero. It is command and control. That's where everything happens. The family, the brothers, the sisters. My wife works in an organization called Meshit, which is a school for underprivileged children and logically disabled children. I say this in the right way, it's a mafia. This one has a school, this one, the brother's the driver, the sister is the. But it's family bonds at all levels, both in the nuclear family as well as in the boy family. They're thicker than water. It creates efficiency, and it creates trust, and it creates success, and dependability, and emotional support. And especially at age where families are becoming more and more dysfunctional, less and less solidified. It's just amazing to see it. And to see how central the Mishpacha is, how central, I know you're editor of Mishpacha magazine, but it's not incidental that that's the name of the magazine. It's not described as some highfalutin ideological thing, it's Mishpacha, because that's a sacred and very perfect. Relatedly, the second aspect, which I think is an outsider, is the jet fuel that powers this community, is when you have a community that expresses need and that faces need. In my community, more or less people are self-sufficient. More or less people are earning gainful employment across the board. But when you have a community in which there's so many people devoting their lives to power, Donald Power, and living by on minimal financial employment, chesed becomes a central feature. I don't know, because I don't live in Ramat Beit Shemesh, but I've been told, I have relatives in Ramat Beit Shemesh, that the book of Yumach is larger than a Sefer Shas. You can buy a Yumach for eyeglasses, and for earplugs, and for nose scratchers, and for hot plates, and for shoelaces, and for, you name it, there's a Yumach. And for time, and for resources, and all the chesed Yumach. You can't build a community based on, now that's stubborn, so shalishalishalashalash. So when you have a community that's built on what's mine is mine, zero to zero, it's a quick slide to Roim Chadoyim. Famous Mara. Who were they? Were they Roim Chadoyim or were they just financial self-sufficient? The answer is first we're financial self-sufficient, and then when you abdicate the need for need, when you abdicate, the concept of dependency, then you form very quickly into self-absorption and egotism and self-indulgence. And to see how chesed is really pivot that community. I like to think that we're involved, I'm sure we're going to sell it, national chesed, and serving an army, and attacking army, so on, but just day-to-day chesed, not conceptual chesed, but literally day-to-day chesed, to extend yourself, live outside of yourself. That's number four. Number five, the incredible kavod that's offered to Tara and to Lomei Tara. And there you could sit in the library, somewhere, learn a lot of Lachimar, learn a lot of Parkham of Panachim, but the sense of authority in Masora, and what people call Nassau, which quite frankly my community doesn't subscribe to, and quite frankly, I don't subscribe to either, and they would be defined as a bit later. But the benefit of Nassau, and the sense of connectivity to our Nassau, and the sense that you should listen to Rabbanim, certainly for halakhic questions, certainly for morally relevant and religious questions, and even in general about life. But once that's for Rabbanim, what do you believe in Nassau? Or honestly, I thought the answer was a no-brainer. They said, of course you say, no, I told you my Nastar across the board. So they just don't think there are any purveyors of Nastar in our generation. But Ram really believes you should ask the Dalai Lama about the Chalcedon, which I was finally asked by. A non-halachic and non-moral issue. And that's something we struggle with, and maybe we talk about a little bit later, how to refuse that type of covenant, tower and covenant, or letting. I know there's a crisis. If you're asking, I'm not part of the modern Orthodox world, I'm part of the national religious world. But my sense is, in a non-Orthodox world, here there's a crisis in Kabbalah, Tara, Kabbalah, Rabbanim. There's a schism that's happening, and Rabbanim have to defend positions that are very difficult to convey. I don't want to talk about it on the fly. There are scandals with Rabbanim, and then it leads into rejection of Rabbanim. Rabbanim, it leads in, and that, from my perspective, is still protected and preserved in the Haredi community. And then finally, my eyes, of course, I apologize. There are many different Muslim schools. And each Muslim school chose its own leader to itself. One of the most famous Muslim schools was the Muslim school of Navarrete. In Navarrete, the meter that they emphasize is defiance. Just to know how to define your world, not to succumb to social pressure or to mockery, to derision. So in Navarrete, you walk into a butcher and you order a hammer. And the butcher would start laughing at you. You idiot, you imbecile. I sell meat, I don't sell hammers. Train myself, not to care. That's an important meter. Not to succumb, not to be vulnerable to people's opinion, to people's derision, and to people's critique, but a life of value, a life of conviction, a life of principle, not to be a monkey dancing in front of the accordion player collecting people's nails. A life of principle. And we all have to pursue that. But for better or for worse, I think living as a Haredi in Eretz Yisrael means you're constantly under siege from the general public, from the general. When I speak to a secular Israeli, to a degree they embrace me, I serve in the army, they see me as a productive contributor to their agenda. Unfortunately, sadly, their view of the Haredi community is less favorable. and express the self constantly in critique and mockery and vitriol, and just be able to live a life that says, you can claim whatever feeling, you know, love me and more about you, not touch on the third writing, but I live this in a higher spirit, and I don't have to worry, but I can't let that small critique compromise my values. Things go up into the community, some people with real moral strength, and that's the short list of six, the really interesting thoughts. I wish I could speak more about it, probably the other people, but please don't think that these are the only six.
I'm leaving straight to the airport, so I took the liberty of packing my black hat. In any event, I was out of yesterday, not really courageous, so I figured it wouldn't help me. For those who weren't completely convinced that I'm a misrepresentative of the community, so you saw the black hat yesterday. Probably it's more necessary here than it would normally be because we have the odd situation where the representative of the National Religious World happens to be a Tamatoka, and the representative of the Haredi world is a person who went to Yale Law School and has been able to use some of his skills on behalf of Klal Yisrael, one hopes, not just the Haredi community, but is not, by any stretch of imagination, in the same getter of the Tamatoka. Okay, I mentioned the first thing that impresses me. First off, promotion made me feel a lot better about being Haredi. I will be interested in reading him. I will be quoting this. This will be a column. The first thing I mentioned yesterday is the incredible staunch emunah. I mentioned that one of my sons said at the Shabbos table last week. He was talking about Rebbe Zinnetlinger, and the interview that he heard with her on the radio, where she was asked, it must be so hard, and we've just gone through Pesach without your husband. And her response was, I didn't hear the whole interview, but her response was, why do we always focus on what we don't have, and not focus on what we do have? It was a Pesach nikla. And my son's comment, this is a son who's the proverbial, you know, best boy in Chevron, who's learning the coaching mishpat today, and he said, when I heard her, I feel so much more confident about the future of Klal Yisrael that we produce people like her, people like I spoke yesterday about the whole family, the three families, plus their son in 2014. When I mentioned that, I thought 2014 was a watershed event in Israeli history, and I'd be interested to hear Moshe's thoughts about that, because I think in my own community, look at the power of the spread of these three families, and we can no longer fool ourselves that we had some kind of an outbreak. And we really it was quite clear that we were observing people of unusual strength. So the first thing, difficult for that movement, and it's something, by the way, in the curriculum, I believe, of the National Religious World, which is much more stressed. It's not left. My host over Shabbos, Rabbi Wolman, has talked much about his Rebbe in the Toronto, with David Saberman. So David Saberman says, oftentimes in the creation world, it's not that we have deep grounding in Amuda. It's that as everything is going along fine, nothing's gone wrong, so we're on a conveyor belt. The only problem is we're no longer on a conveyor belt. It's too little a part of our curriculum. That's awesome. So my subject here is the extent to which it is an intrinsic part of the curriculum at the upper echelons of America, as a rabbi, as a power, and other yeshivas. It's not something that's left to be absorbed by osmosis of the faculty. There's a famous story about Leo Weichlander, who was the principal under Sarah Schneer. As you can tell from his name, he had a PhD. And he was asked, you know, you don't counsel your students to get a PhD, but this is Rumban also had a PhD. She was Dr. Judith Rosenberg from Germany. But you don't counsel your students to get a PhD. And he said, well, there's a difference between two types of people. If somebody tells you he's about to swim the English Channel, you think he's a fool. If he tells you that he swung the English Channel, then you're pretty impressed. So I'm not counseling anybody to go into a university setting and get a PhD, but if somebody did it and emerged intact, well, that's not an inherent school that you went. So I would say, similarly, and Ramosha was right about this, if we're honest with ourselves, we have to admire the Army service. And if we're honest with ourselves, we have to admire particularly, what does it mean to be a young man who every moment that he finds a free moment, who opens up a safe, I'm not saying this characterizes the entire, every soldier who has a kippah sudan, but it characterizes enough at the higher echelon that this is special. I happen to know the father, Zuhari Bamo, Hashem Yikom Bamo, that was found, and there was a lot of discussion of the two other young men who were with him at the time, that he's in the same camp or in the same tank brigade, and I saw that one of the producers said that he went into battle very strong. He always was learning. There was not a time, and they weren't thinking about Zuhari Bamo like, you know, we just found it the third. So I think it's a third, but when you hear something like that, when you hear something somebody who has that and whose connection of learning is a connection of learning that's not in a situation which has made it easy, but it is in a situation which has made it as difficult as possible, but was able to hand for that. You know, if I see one of my kids sleeping late in the morning, I say, well, what are you doing here? I mean, it's just bothers me. I said, you know, if you're not prepared to learn with the same intensity as a soldier who oftentimes finds himself going on 18, 19-hour shifts, if you're not prepared to, if you think you can just get up at any time you feel up in the morning, then you have, what's the determinant for? What is it? And to see those who really maintain their intensity of learning, and I'm not commenting on the quality because I don't have an ability to do that. I don't live in that particular world, and certainly I don't get the emotion set about the plethora of learning that my son said, if you go to the basement library and you see sworn authors who have written on all the shots and you've never even heard their name. How many have written on all the shots? A third thing that impressed me, and I'm asked about it frequently when I'm in America, is a certain amount of pride, a certain amount of stolz in the community. It is sometimes pointed out to me and sometimes I feel it myself. There are many places that it's difficult to dabble in the Haredi world because of the plethora of people from Eretz Israel and locally too. There's plenty of competition who are soliciting funds throughout the dabble. A number of Rabbis, and I noticed it myself, that now there must be poor people in the national religious world. And they probably heard that there are rich people in America, but you will never see, or I have never seen, certainly rarely, to see a person from the national religious world going out with a hand out to davening and shaking their hand. And it is not to our credit, with respect to the Haredi world, the normalization of begging as a way of life, tragically for them. There are too many in certain segments of the community who are born into what's called ancient begging. And that's simply, it's Rachmei Abrios, it's not a minor, it's a chisor, a big chisor. There's a certain amount of pride within the national religious world that, for whatever reason, I'm not really that up on the sociology, it just doesn't exist, you just never see it. And the third thing you find is the fourth thing, I admire the singles of the community. There's two parts of that. And since it is a much multifaceted community, what I'm talking about, what I admire, I'm talking about sometimes what's called the Chardal community, where there's a tremendous emphasis on mitzvahs, addictive to mitzvahs, the importance of learning. Frankly, when I see women in, you know, with a tickle, and as opposed to a $5,000 shekel, and I ask myself, okay, Baltimore's not a $5,000 shekel city. I'm just glancing around with the ears. But when I see other issues and mingling and so forth, but not imagining it so much, that really does stand out. And this is not a small meter, it is a major meter. It's something that's such a hint. If the message that a woman, I'd say it's not limited to things to women alone, but if the idea is that you're clearly demarcated as off limits, I have no connection to you, then the way that the exemplars of this community dress does that as effectively. There's a certain thing which I can't even define, is a certain normalcy. Now, normalcy is not necessarily my, but there are aspects of national religious life that I could somehow say that not so hung up, not so worried all the time, that their normal human endeavors to place forth to do something else, this is also normal and necessary part of life, and physical endeavor and so forth. I can't even put my finger on it, and I know the dangers of it as well. So, but it is something that is widespread. And sometimes looking, you say, okay, on the one hand, it's not, you're not seeing malachim, but you are seeing people who are showing Torah mitzvahs who, it works comfortably. One of my sons just wrote an article for a journal and said, don't ever forget that the Torah is not just a means to get to Ravon Allah. The Torah is supposed to make life in this world pleasant. If you follow God's plan, if you follow Hashem's plan for the world, that he's not there with the rights of the Baraholom, then you should expect things to come out well. Your life should look pretty good in this world too. You should have the happier families. You should have the stronger marriage. It's meant to work in this world too. And sometimes we feel people who are comfortable in their own skin, and that also is something that I admire.
Before I ask you to look in the mirror, if I could ask each of you in turn to do one more thing just to educate us. The Dati Lumi community is multifaceted. There's what you call Hardal, there's those who are right-wing religiously and not so right-wing religiously, there are those who are right-wing politically and those who are not so right-wing politically. There's all kinds of outer appearances and inner differences. And the same is true, of course, for the Haredi community. There are the Litai Haredim, and then there are the Rarim Leib Litai Haredim, and there are Shmuarbach Litai Haredim, and there are Hasidic Haredim, and Hasidim of all kinds. So if you could just take just a few minutes, each of you, to give a little bit more of a sense of the spectrum that exists within each of your communities. Maybe it's time to speak.
Well, it's a little harder in the Haredi community to talk about the spectrum for the simple reason that we're very free to tell somebody you're not really a member of the Haredi community. So that's probably the first difference, is that it's easy for any Haredi group. You're a new Haredi. You're a Haredi Nachadash. You're not really part of us. And the old Yat Kandaman, one of its charms was its continual reading out of the Haredi community on a daily basis, new apostates. So that is a little bit of a problem. We won't have a shared definition, though I think most of us would say that the central value of Talmud Torah probably would be the defining element. But you have many different factions. You know, now we have, for instance, an English speaking Haredi community, a largely immigrant community centered in Ramat Beit Shemesh, which is something new and actually offers opening up possibilities, creating new types of educational institutions for which there will be a large market in the traditional Haredi community. You have, of course, the Lithuanian community and the Hasidic community. I'll just say one interesting point here. If you want to know where change is coming from or where you can, it's more interesting, easy to affect change in the Haredi world. So is it Hasidic world or the Lithuanian world? It's the Hasidic world. because every single Rebbe is a master in his own house. They make even Rabbi Howard, dictator in shul, they make him look like a small fry. The Hasidic Rebbe can do what he does. The Dozer Rebbe does not have to reckon with what the Gear Rebbe will say, what the Vishnitzer Rebbe will say. In his world, it's my way or the highway. That means that an enlightened despot, a leader who is really thinking about what are the needs and what are the changing needs, can institute changes on a dime. He can say, as the Sfas Emes did, as the Imre Emes did when he took over from his father, the Sfas Emes, on a dime, he can decide, okay, we have a problem, a miracle education problem. Every young couple will be mentored for 2 years after marriage. Okay, we have a parnassus problem. So everybody will learn for 2 years after marriage. Then we're going to create frameworks, but the assumption will be that everyone who is not a student and learning will go out into the workplace, but we will also create frameworks to make sure he better be in the base midrash. You know, he'll have a regular siddurim, and these are communally enforced and communally known. So the Bozer Rebbe can, if the most dramatic change is taking place on quite a top-down model, not just welding up from the bottom, will come in the Hasidic world. Whereas, as the disputes in the Lithuanian world show, everyone has to look over their shoulders. Rav Shach was probably the single most powerful leader in 50 years at least, and maybe longer. Nevertheless, I'm afraid of the stone throwers. Rav Eliashiv, the universally acknowledged Hosek Hador in his time, was pelted with AIDS and probably had stones thrown at him in his own Manishurim neighborhood. You cannot ignore what we will be accused of. I once said to a Rosh Hashiva, he told me, I just put out my new book on Bayom Tzman, and I said, well, how many do you have, how many address poverty? So he said, none. I said, well, isn't poverty implicated on 80% of the problems in our community? It's not that it's the only problem, but it's implicated, it's part of another. So I said, well, if I talk about poverty, I have to talk about education. If I talk about education, then I no longer be considered courageous. So that's a problem. That's a problem. If that's the case, then we have a serious, we certainly have a serious leadership gap. In the essential world, it is possible with the enlightened leader to have rapid changes. In the Spartan world, so the Spartan world is itself complex. Most of that world is not in full-time learning. What is the groups that are in full-time learning are generally Talmidim, those who are saved out of the Maharot in the early 50s and themselves learned in Ponovich, and almost Lithuanian in their orientation because their Rosh Hashiva was learned in Lithuanian Yeshiva. It's not true for Rabbi Bati Yosef, and there was Parag Yosef and so forth. Baal Tshuvas also constitute a large portion of the Haredi world, probably larger, even larger in America, but I believe that this is going to be growing in Israel, and that would also create tensions. I mean, the integration of Baal Tshuva is a major problem. It's done by taking them away from their normal communities and their families and where they come from to try to force everyone into Kiryat Sefer and Helad and so forth. The only result will be disaster. Integration of Baal Tshuva is a very serious problem, but it's a serious problem here, it's a serious problem in America, in Israel. So that, you know, and each Baal Tshuva is inevitably much different because having been raised in a different world, he's from a different perspective. I said to somebody, I'm not a very critical person of today. I said, I don't believe you're not a critical person. I said, no. The only difference between me and some others is that I once lived in another world. So the Mela, I have a different perspective. I look at everything that I see. If I hear a speech at the Gugu Convention, I hear it from one ear, from my Haredi ear, from my secular parents, and so there's always a certain bifurcation. So the growing Baal Tshuva community also constitutes its own unique community. Okay, well, that's something of the palate of the Haredi world.
Okay. Just to issue a caveat on the question, the premise of today's conversation is itself troubling because, maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later, I don't see how these surroundings, cantons and sects and groups and camps and it's one long band, one large band of Ami Israel, and 300 years ago these terms didn't exist, and 300 years they won't exist, or a particular point in time in which we define ourselves based on certain systems and values. But for the purpose of clarity and identification, we titled today the Haredi National Religious. So now we're taking a deeper dive. Let's not just divide between Haredi and National Religious, let's create divisions within National Religious. So again, for the purpose of clarity and illustration and information, I'll tolerate this terminology and the premise, but I fundamentally disagree with it. My Baruch Hashem made a wedding 6-7 weeks ago. My daughter belongs to one camp, which I'll describe, Mary Boyd Gamara Moore, who belongs to it. And everyone asked me, how am I accepting it? How do I experience the chuppah? I thought she was insulted by the question. That was the most racist question you could ever ask. I love my son-in-law, I love his parents, and I was shocked that anyone could ask me that question. So again, please, take a step back. This is one big parenthesis. This is one big kibayachal. We'll talk about the different camps and movements and tendencies, but it's not as if people are defining themselves with brick walls and large barbed wire fences. In general, people refer to this within the national religious world, the Latino Indian world, they refer to two camps. For some of my children, no. This is all my children. I disagree with what you call that. One is called the Gushnik camp, and one is called the Kavnik camp. Kavnik is easier. Kav means a line, kuflav, and that generally refers to the yeshiva world that has propagated from Rav Kook, his yeshiva, Merkaz and Rav Kook, and all the breakaways. So there are a lot of these breakaways, some of the more well-known, although they don't have as big an imprint in America as they should. A place such as Hachamor, where my son-in-law learns, they just opened a base medicine, you should have 800 seats. And just to give you a sense of the dimension, you know, it's small, looking granny. Har Bracha, Elo Moreh, Beit El, of course, Merkaz Harav. None of these names mean anything, but these are Eli, which is then, of course, many of the Mechina institutions, which are not directed towards producing Talmid Chachamim, will sit and learn, creating pre-army religious experiences so that they'll be strong and proud Jewish soldiers and officers and ultimately influence society. The Gushnik camp, because the Shiva teaching is Goshen, was really, it was the second Hezri Yeshiva, but it was the first Hezri Yeshiva we see as a model Hezri, the first Hezri Yeshiva, the Chagoga, the Chagoga, but he didn't have a consciousness that he was built in mind. It was the only place that people were going to learn. And some of the Yeshivas that have expanded from that place, such as Mahalei Adumim and Yerucham, where my sons live, and Karabacha and Mahalot, and these yeshivas have started to reflect certain attitudes. What are the differences between people that tilt towards a covenant approach, or tilt towards, not only these who are Gushmi, because that's all self-promotional, but that broader has their type of approach? Kav means a line, and line suggests or implies black and white. Things are, this is social codes. It's either right or it's wrong. I remember when I was discussing with my in-laws about the Mahi Lachmanin, about the Chasana, and certain questions came up. Who's going to walk a child down the aisle? Who's going to sit in the chuppah? This way, that way. So from my perspective, I don't think about what makes sense, what the children want, what the audience. And the voice that I picked up from them, what I was fine, I was very happy to be flexible about it, was that this is the way we do it. There's a code. There's a code about shidduchim, there's a code about marriage, there's a code about the wedding, there's a certain way to live your life by without becoming, without emasculating personal discretion, personal decision making, but there's more of a black and white.
Just scribble some ideas down. I think probably the first difference, and this is not necessarily in order, is I think the role of Talmud Torah for women. In the Hesder Kush world, there's an explosion of Talmud Torah for women in the classic setting. By the way, the real secret of the change in Talmud Torah for women has nothing to do with ideology. It has everything to do with the internet. The internet has transformed women's learning on two levels. First of all, women who would feel uncomfortable or not inclined to attend the classic shiur, or shiur were only available for men, they can sit in their kitchen and press a button here. So the internet's reality always trumps ideology. Reality always overtells ideology. And not only, of course, women accessing Torah, but women delivering Torah. Certain people will feel uncomfortable listening to a female delivering a shiur in a certain setting, but they feel a little more comfortable logging onto a website and listening to a certain opinion. So I think in my yeshiva, Yeshiva Har Etzion, has a women's division, and it has close to 300 young women studying Torah at different stages. So I think, and it's not just Talmud Torah, but I think text-based Talmud Torah, rather than what we would call the classic seminary, which is the people who more call shaping, creating values, creating knowledge necessary to build a Jewish home, creating hashkafos, as opposed to creating direct encounters with a text. And it could be Tanakh, it could be Mara, those, of course, subdivisions of that question. Number two, and this is an important one, it's a little bit subtle. My Rebbe, Ravaran and Rav Amital, were what I would call institutionalists. Namely, every Dati Lomi person sees themselves as an integral part of the state. We serve in the army, we participate in state-building measures, it's our responsibility. But what happens when the state disagrees with your opinion? What happens when there's a secular government? What happens when there are positions? So in that world, and one of the primary personas in that world is someone named Riftau. That's one of the leaders of that, with Aaron Moore. He draws a line in the sand. You are opponents. We will fight this decision. We'll fight this position. We'll disobey orders in the army. We won't be free. We've heard some of these conversations. In our world, this is our army. This is our police force. This is our government. When I've sat at staff meetings in our yeshiva where the army is demanding that the boys spend an extra 2 months because they have an extra need for manpower, and it's hard for us because we want them back in the yeshiva. But the army wants them for an extra 2 months. So we discuss it, we argue, we debate, but it's never as if they're the enemies, they're the opposing forces. It's the army versus our community. It's our army, it's our police force. We have to juggle competing values. And I lived through this in the 90s where the government was more or less secular, more or less left-leaning, the Oslo Accords. And I never heard defaming or derogatory comments about the government. My Rebbe Rav Amital joined the government in 1995 as a minister for various reasons. I guess they supported the government. I call it institutionalists, that we're part of the institution. This is our country. If the army has a manpower need, it's our problem. And now we have to juggle it with other issues rather than these are our values, the army is threatening those values, the government is threatening those values, let's duke it out with that. The third issue is, I think that in that world, there's a little bit more of a nationalist strain. And I talked about this a little bit over Shabbos, but we're all involved in Eretz Yisrael and very nationalist agenda. We're trying to build our land and settle our land and bring Mashiach and build communities of Torah. But how does that affect the fact that we're B'nai Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, we have to care about the entire world? I was a rav in a program over Pesach in Eretz Yisrael. And I think it was Monday night before I gave whatever shiur was given. They said, we're saying a parable of Tehillim for the victims of Sri Lanka. I couldn't imagine going to dinner and stuffing myself with another steak and another smorgasbord when 500 people were killed in Sri Lanka and another, who knows how many were made. And that's part of my Vodas Hashem. How can I look Avraham Avinu in the eye when I get the Shemayim? And these people are just being murdered in cold blood, and I don't care, I'm not interested. So every year there's both, and Rabbi Kiva said, Chaviv Adam Shenifer B'Tzelem, every person has a Tzelem Molokim, Chaviv Yisrael Shenifer B'Tzelem. So everyone has to try to find that balance between the pride and the parochialism and the focus of a Yid, but also the fact that you're responsible for this entire world, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes us the Am HaNivchar, not for privilege, but for responsibility. We're responsible for every person. So I'm sure it's the same challenge for Bachar Yekol Yerulet, learning in B'nai Brak, but when you're actively involved, not just in learning Torah and that insular experience, but you're trying to settle the land, and quite frankly, you've got people who are opposed to your settlement of the land, who are living there with natural rights, it ramps up, it redistributes that challenge. I live in the West Bank, and I believe every inch of this land is ours, and one day will be ours. But right now, I'm shopping in Rami Levi with Palestinian citizens, and I'm very courteous to them, and I help them with their children, and they don't need to be walked out. I was saying yesterday, I'm very mocked on the roads when I drive. I always give the Palestinians the right of way at the traffic circle, because my heart goes out to them. For me to get to Jerusalem, it takes me 30 minutes. For a Palestinian grandfather who's a normal, regular citizen, he's not a terrorist, it takes me 2 hours to go to the checkpoints and to go to the questions. And the least I can do is restore a little bit of itself and my buddy will before me in the traffic circle. I think in that world, there's less universalism. There's less of that sense. It's very, this is our land, and this is our time, and this is our period. And of course, in extremities, you've got some very violent and disgraceful behavior, vandalizing our property, burning olive trees, chas v'shalom, what happened when this woman was killed. But, and in that sense of, you know, our world is a little more inspired by the self-hatred and that humanism, universalism. So I would say that's probably the third difference. I think their world is very, very politically charged. I think when I read Tanakh, I try to connect Tanakh to current events. But that's a very, very dangerous proposition. So I connect it in general. Yassus alaycha l'koyach kimsos chasen al-kala. That's not from Tanakh. And I read Od Yeshuas Akenus, Kenus Bechavos Yerushalayim. So I feel like the Nevuah of Zechariah is taking place in general. Yassus Hashem Yassus al-Sin Niflos Be'enin. I feel like we're living in a time of Niflos. In a very general sense. I think in that world, there's more of a direct insertion of political events into Tanakh. I remember my son was spent the Shabbos in the army. I said, and a Rebbe from one of these yeshivas came and spent Shabbos with him in the army. So I said, his son, his name is David. David, tell me, how'd you like Shabbos? He gave some shiur. He said, it's very interesting now, but why? Because he's talking about current events in Tanakh. So he tell me. He says, Trump is Melech Hizkiah, and Clinton is Amir Russia, and this Russia refers to this congressman. So I think there's a politicalization that I feel like we were taught to be a little bit delicate about, a little bit reserved about, without trying to be too enthusiastic and naive, and all of a sudden you're your dad, Hassel, you know, this is possible, and all of a sudden determine that decision. I think I made one other point. I just pull out my. And as part of institutionalism, as I mentioned before, it's not just institutionalism as part of the police, and it's our army, and it's our police force, and it's our means, it's our responsibility, but also I'm starting to feel, how do you relate to secular Israelis? And this is a bit ironic, because the covenant world stems from Rav Kook. Rav Kook is such an embracing, integrating, but I think that in that world, the covenant world, they're seen as either annoyances, maybe seen as opponents. I don't sense the same. I feel a deep sense of fraternity with every single Israeli. These are my partners. I'm sad that my partners are secular. But I feel like these are the people with whom I'm building Jewish destiny. These are the people that are part of Am Yisrael. Unfortunately, they're still not at Har Sinai. I'm trying to bring them back to Har Sinai. And it's not just an attitude. When I turn on the radio and listen to a secular Israeli song, I don't mean the trash popular culture. I mean some of the very soulful songs. I don't know the names of my children play in Rosh Hashanah. I feel a deep neshama. And they're not singing a pasuk from Tehillim, and they're not singing a pasuk. I just feel there's a neshama. It's connected to Eretz Yisrael. It expresses itself in ways that aren't classically religious, whether it's commitment to land, commitment to people, commitment to this spirit of being. I don't sense that as much in that world. I think there's been a bit of an alienation and a bit of a split that they sense between the religious world and the secular world. And obviously there's a split, but I think it's becoming a little bit alien. That's something that, those are some of the differences. But again, we don't check everyone's ideas at the door and all of a sudden, which group do you belong to? Which group do you belong to? Certainly not within these subdivisions. That's kind of common within what people call Haredi or sometimes people ask me, how would you define yourself? I say, I'm an ultra-Orthodox Jew. So what do you mean? I said, I don't think any Yid has the right not to be an ultra-Orthodox Jew. How could you ever imagine not calling yourself an ultra-Orthodox Jew? And if I'd be responsible to be as firm as I can. I feel this is the derech that my Rebbeim showed me. I'm trying to be as firm as I can in that derech. And if I felt that by becoming a Haredi type person, I could be more firm, I would decide. And I tell my kids all the time, if he leaves you from Kai, it'll be like driving a stake through my heart. If you want to go to Punnabis, we'll drive you.
What's your next question?
We
don't have enough time.
There's
so much
more
to say.
You definitely don't have enough time. What I'm asking now is if we could go to the step of looking into the mirror. And you know, each of you live within a community in which you have a lot of pride, and certainly a community in which you certainly also fret about it and worry about what would be the greatest steps to take it forward. I'm going to ask you, please.
You've heard of the concept of distinction of five differences. It's interesting. For me, don't really bother about Moshe. The other camp in the Yeshivish, the national religious world, is much more, the feeling of the divisions are much more acute. I mean, we left out, by the way, in the summary, a large number, perhaps the majority of people in Eretz Yisrael that identify themselves as national religious, but are not Yeshivish, not in the Rav Tau, Derech, and not in the Rav Lichtenstein, Derech, who are not in, that. Anyhow, with respect to my own community, the Belzer Rebbe said not so long ago on his standing tour, he said, what has taken place in Eretz Yisrael over the last 50 years since the Kuma Medina, 1948, whatever, it is a miracle that Torah should have flourished in the Bnei Brak of the 1950s. There were maybe 200-250 yeshiva like. I mean, the numbers are so incomprehensible today. The flowering of Torah, the number of really almost unsung Talmidim coming because they're so numerous that they don't necessarily stand out. But then he made the following comment. In order for us to preserve that which was achieved over the last 50 years, 70 years, will require no less of a miracle. Because you don't preserve a society. Society can never go along just doing what it has been doing and is expected to work. One very incisive Rav told me, it's not the same community. The community that built the Torah world in Eretz Yisrael that rallied to the banner of the Chazanish was homogenous, highly idealistic, highly talented, a group of young men of limited numbers who were willing to sacrifice anything. Now that's grown to a world which is 20% of the school children under 9 years old in Israel today. It's an increasing, almost 25% of the population, or will be at some point. This is, and that's something completely different. We've gone from what he called to an Ada to a Tzibor. We've gone to a public writ large, which is of heterogeneous, a variety of spiritual levels, a variety of intellectual attainments. The model that applied formally cannot apply. You can't just, it's not just something writ large. You can't just, it's not just an extrapolation of the world that existed and what this was built about. And if you don't make those adjustments, and they're much more complicated when you're dealing with a united, homogenous group based on a single ideal, and you take that ideal to heart, then it's, they can achieve remarkable things. And now, the biggest challenge that we face, probably all of us as parents, as a society, is how does a one-model society, how does a model that was created in the Chazanish explicitly said, this is to rebuild Torah after the destruction of the Holocaust. This is a two-generational affair. It's like the 40 years that the Bnei Yisrael were in the desert. But now that period has come to an end. It's unsustainable. The general rule in economics is that trends that can't continue forever won't. There will be a movement from below. There will be tensions. They can't just continue. A major Rosh Hashiva, actually one of the manhigim of the Haredi world, recently told somebody, you don't think that 50% of the young men in our community are going to be running a call 15 years from now. That's not going to happen. But even the Kol HaMano, the fact that we sold the model, which was meant to be a Horat Shah, as if it were the from time immemorial, is problematic. Now, there's so many people who realize, I'm not excited by my learning, I'm starving, but it's hustle for me to go out to work. That's a tragedy. Every society has a certain amount of mythologies. But when they're taken too seriously, and the sense of the mythologies is not sufficiently recognized, then you have a problem. The model as it exists is at odds with the traditional Jewish family, the idea that the wife should become the major breadwinner is difficult. She's going to have 8 kids, be the major breadwinner, be a mother, and as Rebbe Zvi Feinstein said, and you also want a wife too? You're asking a It's very difficult. And then the bigger problem, she goes out and she's a big success and she gets a high-tech job and she's able to support the family and she's a supermother. So how does she look at her husband who's not bringing any money? That's also, psychologically, that is, it's a role reversal that has to be addressed. And it is felt as a problem. Creating multiple models, you can't tell every child. If your fifth grader is struggling and able to see us, I'm up here, and he says to you, what am I going to be when I grow up? And the only thing that you can tell him is you're going to be a coal. And you go, Mom, you signed a death sentence on him. You told him you'll always be mediocre. You'll always be second best. If you give him an option, I have a son who is my least talented learner. I always worried about him the most. But he's the happiest of the, I would say he's in some ways the happiest today. He learns in the morning. He has a regular Seder in the morning. And he repairs major appliances. It's the most rewarding job that there can be in the world. You come in and everybody's in despair. The laundry's all over the place. The food hasn't been cooked. The refrigerator, everything. The food is all rotting. You walk out, everybody's happy. Instant gratification.
Can I have his number? This is a very hard table to find.
It's even better than my account. Find those models. Now, as there is going to be a major movement into the workforce, and there are certain skills that we're lacking. We have literally, to some extent, crippled our children. I would name three at least. Without English, you can't do anything in the computer field. And I've been in places where brilliant American college graduates are struggling to learn English to go into a program like Arbitech. And I said to them, and this guy was an ASIN. Then we'll skip the ASIN. So he was an ASIN. And I said, are you going to teach your child English? He said, you bet. It's just, if anybody with any experience of what it's like to struggle at 25 to learn English, basic numeracy, to get some mathematical knowledge, these things are going to be necessary for an increasing number of people, not only the women, because you don't support 8 children on 2 salaries either. These are real challenges, and the challenge then will be also, as you enter into a world, how do you integrate into that world? And unfortunately here, I would say, we don't have too many models. I mean, what we've seen to date is we have a lot of self-fulfilling prophecy. People who go out to work are told if you go out to work, you'll go down in your religious observance, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You go out to work, okay, I'm no longer going to be in the Yeshiva world, on comes the blue shirt, on comes this, start listening to the regular, music. I'm putter, I'm free. It's like becoming a conservative Jew. No, I don't keep Shabbos, I'm a conservative Jew. Like it's a patur. Somebody's labeled you a new Haredi. How do you retain your identity? How do you remain a Ben Torah for life? I mean, there's certainly efforts to address this. Rob Label's created a Marechet of 600, I don't know how many exactly, but dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of nighttime calling for people who are learning. The problem is recognized, but it's not going to be so easy to deal with. And in this case, there's a sort of warning from the national religious world. And I want to push Rob Moshe to address this, because I'm sure he's felt it too. When you get too close, and you have no sense of distinction. The theory was, we'll bring them closer to us. They'll see we're normal people like them. So we'll be in the workplace, we'll be in the army, and so forth and so on. And then they'll be attracted to us. But what they see is, you're not essentially different from us, and you're very concerned with showing that, actually, I'm very much like you. And as a matter of fact, they're not attracted. They don't feel bothered. They like you until the Rabin assassination, and then you're a killer, until the Gush Katif withdrawal, and then you're the greatest danger that faces society. In some ways, the national religious community has been hit with more vitriol than the Haredi community. It's true that they're not like, they're not viewed as one of them, but this community has been pounded on at various times. I was once asked, and here I'll finish, I was once asked by Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg in Boca Raton, and I asked him, why are you Haredi? What makes you Haredi? So I said, they came looking for me. Or Samantha, Eshet Torah, you name it, they were looking for me. They had a passion for that world, and they weren't embarrassed to say that they were different. In today's world, when people seek out religion, when people seek out a spiritual life that they find absent, almost inevitably they turn to what is seemingly could be defined as more extreme America, to evangelism, the mainstream churches have just disappeared, basically fallen off the map. They don't exist. In the reform and conservative movements, almost don't exist, are imploding that situation. It's hard to see them being here for any period of time. It doesn't work to try to say, be like me, to see I'm really like you. They also have to see what makes you different. They have to make you see what you live for. They have to make you see it. It's not, that doesn't mean you can't be the biggest friend. It doesn't mean that you can't say, I have what to learn from you, as we spoke about yesterday. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that we don't have a common bond because we're all Jews. But if you think being Shomer Shabbos of being committed to Torah is just a little maraschino cherry on the top into the fact that we also serve in the army, we also work in the workplace, then that's not going to work in terms of bringing others to us. And to the extent that you seek that kind of relationship, your own continued religiosity is put at danger and under threat.
Okay, I know the time is brief. I would say that there are 3.5 challenges facing my community that just come to mind at first glance. The first one, and Rabbi Yonasan alluded to it, it's always easier to educate in binary terms, black and white, good and bad, in or out, on or off. And to a degree in America, you have that binary experience no matter which community you belong to, because either you're from and you have the shul, you keep kashrus, or you're out. If you're out, it's a quick fall. And it's a very, very precipitous fall. So what does it mean to be out of the community? Basically out of Jewish containment and Jewish identity. But the national religious community is built on a collage of values. Talmud Torah, Chesed, Tefillah, Tzedakah, the classic ones, but also state building, an army, an Israeli culture. And as adults, we're good at ranking. We're going to say, okay, well, they're all important values, but this is how they rank. Talmud Torah is at the top of the pyramid, and Tefillah, I'm not posing one against the other. This is also important. And attitudinally, it's an important message. Just some nice rivalry. At a certain point, there's a clash. So we'll have to favor Talmud Torah or Shiras HaMitzvot or some other aspect. Teenagers are very poor at ranking. Teenagers like black and white, in or out, good or bad. What is it? Tell me, give me my marching orders. Or Kyrie. And that really riddles our society. And I think the last moment it hit me, I've thought about this for many years, is when Shimon Peres was there 2 years ago. You should hear how in our community was eulogized and lauded for all of his accomplishments, and there were significant accomplishments. He curbed inflation in the 80s, and he was instrumental in discovering nuclear. I'm in no way diminishing his accomplishments. I'm not vilifying him. So my ears process that I still don't look at him as a role model. I said, I don't put a picture of Shimon Peres on my wall. I've got pictures of the Golem on my wall, but I can accentuate his contributions, how he affected Jewish history. I can eulogize him. That's very hard for kids. It's extremely hard for kids. Or when a secular soldier dies in battle, and everyone gathers, and they eulogize him, he dies in Kiddush Hashem, he served Am Yisrael, and the adulation is enormous. So my ears say, but he certainly deserves that cover, but obviously you want more. If you're a 15-year-old and you're struggling with your Moses Hashem, every teenager is, maybe I could choose out my stuff and be an Air Force pilot, and I'll still be accepted, I'll still be successful, I'll still be... It's not just how you define success identity-wise, I'll still be part of the Jewish community. It's not as if I'll be excluded, I'm still contained. I spoke yesterday with Shabbos about the state of Israel being a great container for people who are no longer religious, given Jewish identity and commitment to Jewish destiny. But that same benefit also creates this illusion and mirage that I can still be Jewish and meaningful and productive. That's the primary issue. It's not just value, but it's also people. As Yonasan alluded to before, we want to try to integrate people, but where do you draw the lines, and who do you allow into your world? That's the primary issue, and that's why sadly there's a lot of what's it like, there will be an intro from Shira fallout and people falling off of defection and disaffectedness, all the different stages, different forms, is a phrase in Eretz Yisrael called Dati Light, which is becoming more and more popular in our community. That I think is the first challenge. The second challenge is as follows. I talked about this yesterday in Shul, so I apologize to the people who were there, but I was at the end of the share, I was a little bit rushed. Our relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu was pivoted on two emotions and two attitudes and two interfaces. One is Avas Hashem, one is Yiras Hashem. Avas Hashem means we try to understand religion, how it affects us, how it improves us, Kim Chayim Berachim Benyam, as you went through before, Achei Kodesh Tirim, Lidakatska, Achei Kodesh. When we understand Darkei Hashem, then we're able to understand Darkei Hashem. So we love Kodesh Baruch Hu because, I mean, just think for a moment where you'd be now at 11:30 on a Sunday morning if you weren't at Torah. So enough a YouTube video, enough a sports event, enough a Dunkin' Donuts. A certain point it grows old. The Baruch Hashem, everyone here has meaning and values and ideals and families, and this is a Matana from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, the Midbar Matana, Torah's our Matana. And that's why you love a Kodesh Baruch Hu. You don't love a Kodesh Baruch Hu because it tastes good. You don't love a Kodesh Baruch Hu because he's handsome. When you get older, you love ideas that change your life and improve you. We see Avodas Hashem as improving and enhancing in our life. That's one pivot. The other pivot is Yiras Hashem. We just don't understand Kodesh Baruch Hu. The world doesn't make sense. You can't crack the mystery. You submit to the divine world of Baruch Shalom. Ate Adat Kirei Elokim Mata. What sense can anyone make of the Akeda? And you submit. And if that, how we saw this, always been a balancing act, a calibration. Chassidus reintroduced a little more simcha and avas Hashem in a very dark world that was dominated by Yiras Hashem. What's happened in my world in Eretz Yisrael is avas Hashem with steroids. Because we feel like history has turned and there's been a shift and the Baruch Hu is back in a visible and tangible fashion and he's assisting us and he's driving the process and look at all the military victories and look at the spectacular success and we're back in our land, we're back with our people, and Shiram is open, every pasuk has meaning, and we enjoy, and I think there's a great benefit to that, a real intimacy with Kodesh Baruch Hu. That's why Chassidus has become so popular in our world, because it stresses that intimacy, and there's a real sense of closeness to Kodesh Baruch Hu, which I think is fantastic. But it has come at a very, very steep price to Yiras Hashem. If I could wave a wand over my community and make one change, it would be to increase the dosage of Yiras Hashem. We don't understand everything. You can't understand. You can't just bank on the Baruch Hu's will. To me, the watershed moment was in the disengagement from Gaza and 2005. And there's some leading Dati Lumi, National Religious Rabbanim, who issued a statement which was destructive. Hayolotia, what happened? I was mortified. 7 years after the Holocaust, 7 years in the Baruch Hu Medical Field of Baruch Hu, you're going to say, you're going to guarantee the Ratzon Hashem, you're blown all of a sudden? And that's why there were so many 35-year-old Dati Lumi young men when they weren't there, because they woke up the next day and it happened. And everybody probably wouldn't happen. But I know where it comes from. It comes from the sense of, we're back, and Kodesh Baruch Hu's on our side, he's my kid brother, and I can rely on him, and I can talk to him, and I can... It was very, very instructive to notice the opposition to the disengagement from Gaza, which came from the Haredi world. I wasn't so attuned to it, but when I saw some of the letters that came out, the tonality was totally different. The letters, the Tashkivim said, we're another Darchei Hashem, Esar Liyako, Amarti Echma Yerucho, and much according to Sefer Yud. And then at the bottom, let's daven Hashem, this shouldn't happen. It was a totally different... In our world, there's, yeah, me and the Baruch Hu were buddies. I got the inside track. Tell me it won't happen. I can promise you it won't happen. And that world was... We're still living in a world that doesn't make sense sometimes. And there's an audacity. You talked about that sneeze before. I agree with, there's a lack of intellectual sneeze. A lack of religious sneeze. Your son now is learning Sechash and Mishpat. So my son is probably learning Kodesh Mishpat. It's going to take 30 minutes of his time to think about Geula and the role of Kodesh Baruch Hu and Sefer Kuzari and what's happening in our world. And let me, your son is in the Shulchan Aruch. He's in the lines of the Shach and the Taz. So obviously he knows it's not Hashem, but he's listening to authoritative information being displayed. Whereas my son, but people in our community say, let me send to Shamayim and think about Zechari Moselam, Binash Nazdar, what does this all mean? Which I think is important, but it has to be grounded. And I'm always thankful for my Rabbeinu because I think they created that groundedness. That the Zionism of my Rabbeinu is very, very grounded in post-Holocaust survival and creating a viable state. It wasn't as meteoric, enthusiastic, the world's ending tomorrow, and we're on the right side of history. It was just very, very muted and very, very carefully calibrated. The third and final issue is, and I don't know, maybe Riona said any comment on this. A couple of years ago, in Yeshiva, we had a Hanukkah panel. So we invited, it was Baal Haredim and Datila, we invited a Rav Bergbrun, is that his name? That's Yeshiva, Israeli person, also Israelis. He came and spoke, and at some point, one of the boys said, I don't understand. Why do you keep telling the Tamina that we're not from, and we don't know how to learn? And just look at what you're looking at here in our Yeshiva. So I was very impressed with his answer. He's very honest. He said, I can't let them see you, because then my whole propaganda will fail. I've got to convince them to buy into my system, and I can't show them the military. I was like so impressed with his honesty. So I think I sense there's a lot of propaganda, but I also sense they don't really listen. I don't feel disdain from the Yeshiva Bach. I feel a lot of love, a lot of admiration. Part of it is also because, in the end of the day, you're being protected by army, you're being delivered funds by state. As crazy as it sounds, it's going to sound very ironic, there's a lot of disdain and contempt and prejudicial stereotyping in my community about Haredi. It's very, very painful. I call it Haredi phobia. I mean, America exists, but also, oh yeah, they all cheat on their income taxes and steal parking spaces. That really parasites there. It's extremely painful. To a degree, it's demographic. Where do you live? And I remember when Alon Shuvah decided to allocate plots of land, the place that I lived, the Yishuv, so it was a point system. Who would get plots of land to build a house? You got 1 point for each shahrgrad, and 1 point for each year you lived in the community, and 25 points if you served in the army. So basically, it was anti-Haredi discrimination. There's no way a Haredi could ever hope to. And we don't live together. Baruch Hashem, we have family, I have community, my wife, so I'm part of that world, but not demographically or socially. And it's not just that it's detestable at a meter-stick level, it's also counterproductive. I was speaking a few months ago at one of these events about why some of the Tatibumi children are off the derech and losing it. I said, it's your own fault. Because if you vilify Haredim, and the only Torah models that the kids should look up to, the few Rabbanim in the Tilumi world that you can identify, of course it's a very lame example, but if you present a broad-based spectrum, you want so many Gedolim, so much Torah, this is our Derech, a little Derech that way, let's quote this one, quote that one, you're basically shooting yourself in the leg. You're performing such a narrow, almost hollow set of role models, or here in America. I remember I was once speaking to a boy, and I said he's going back to an out-of-town location, and I said, where are you going to live for the summer? He says, there's really no place to live. It's a small town. This is a legal call, but I would never walk in there. I was devastated. I looked him in the eye and said, let's say you were a dialysis patient. And the only hospital in town that offered dialysis was St. Luke's. Would you not walk in there? So if Torah is your lifeline, you accept it in any form possible. And you know all this mishigas about the hats and the jackets and the shirts and the... Who cares? So that really bothers me in my community, attitudinally. And it's also very self-defeating. It's not just attitudinally smug, but it also is counterproductive.
I just want to say it's such a pleasure to be together with Rav Tarja. We didn't agree about everything, and we won't agree about everything, but I know I feel uplifted. This is the second time we've done this. Last was about 9 years ago. But it's still... It still is fresh in my mind, and this will remain even fresher. So.
No. It's my honor to sit. I'm Gavin Shipping Fan of Marvel Shipping Jews. I'll continue to be my good story. Your job's a lot harder than mine.
Zevi Waldman and everybody put this together. I just want to say one thing. I know there was a request to leave. But the concept of Elo Bele Dibre Elokim Chayim has been around before Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. The Marshal says when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Torah, it was already understood in different ways. You see when Yaakov Avinu gives brachas to his sons, he's already expressing diversity. You see, according to the Netziva, we're supposed to exist with Yaakov and Esau, different ways of expressing, really, Avodas Hashem. But if there's one insight, just to build on what Rabbi Matzin said, with Yaakov Kamenetsky's idea that the Gullim work with their surrounding Torah, I think what you learn from Yaakov Avinu is for diversity to work, you need to get people sitting in the same room. The Yaakov Avinu specifically says, he wants everybody, all his sons to come together to understand that we need each other. And that's so important. And what I saw, when I was in Israel, I switched from Karim Biyata, which was a Hesder Yeshiva, which was Dati Lomi, now I learned there's another term, a Kav Yeshiva, to the Chevron Yeshiva, which was a Haredi Yeshiva. And what I saw was there really was no understanding of the other. I don't think it was hatred. I think it was really just no understanding. They never spoke to each other. And that's why this is so important. Beyond the incredible insights, what I learned here today is the respect that can exist and that should exist. And we're in the days that we commemorate Talmid Rabbi Akiva, Shalom Nagu Kavod Zeh LaZeh. This today is an expression of Kavod Zeh LaZeh, and I hope it continues. And in that schus, may we see the ultimate goal of the Aryan Nation.
I'm going to get my wife to come out, and I have a lot of pieces on Meshi, too, which I'll send you a few.
It's very interesting. One of the pieces of paper.
Oh, yeah, take it. I'm sorry. Take it. Take whatever you want.
I need the bonus.
Oh, yes. Okay.
How do you get what?
The biggest thing that I took from Turkey Elvis was a thing on Antigonus and Sopho. I just think about it probably. You know what I'm talking about. I'll tell you, Kevin. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. That's Richard Webb. We've had many times over the years. It's good to see you, and I hope that your message will be heard here and in the
I'm an old friend of Jonathan's, but I used to work with your second cousin, so Ari Terrigan.
Jonathan Rosen.
Yeah, way after him. My name is Yaakov Kuhn. It was very, very
And by doing this program, once we it's like unbelievable. Like, we speak for Baltimore,
around
it.
Like,
it's never touched.
So you guys are
I can only speak for Baltimore. I can't speak for
I think I'm recording now, actually, as we're talking. I didn't, but I did record it. No, I did record it. So I'll put it up.